You're all very welcome to Maynooth University, and welcome back to those of you who are at some of our other events over the course of the year, to this series of talks and discussions that form the basis of the University's 2016 commemorative program. The focus on women and the decade of commemorations in all-Ireland perspective arose from the realization that Ireland's past commemorations had tended to largely ignore female figures from the past and their contributions to historical events, while also excluding the work of women scholars and tending to ignore the social circumstances of women in contemporary Ireland. And since the 50th anniversary commemorations of the Easter Rising are sometimes considered to have contributed to the troubles that followed, we approached these centenary commemorations with the knowledge that an all-Ireland perspective would not only be important, but also wise. The approach that we have taken is thus an inclusive one, aiming to consider commemorations from a variety of perspectives. We have sought to showcase the work of women scholars, activists, and writers from around the island of Ireland, and to consider the significance of women's roles in events of 100 years ago, on this island and in Europe. We have also sought to have different perspectives on commemoration represented so that commemoration is not merely celebratory, but also reflective, inclusive, and considerate of the future relationships of people on this island. Initial funding for this series generously came from the Department of Foreign Affairs, Peace and Reconciliation Fund, but I'm pleased to say that Maynooth University has responded to our initial proposal by making Women in the Decade of Commemorations an all-island perspective its official commemoration program for 2016. As a result, we will be able to extend this series of events over the course of the year, and we would urge you to spread the word and to stay in touch, as all of these events are free, open to the public, and have at their core the aim of encouraging discussion. There have already been changes evident in the way in which this centenary year has unfolded. When in the autumn we planned this series, we were seeing the beginnings of the Waking the Feminist movement in response to the Abbey Theatre's misguided Waking the Nation programme, which of course excluded the work of female playwrights and directors to an extraordinary degree. The uproar about the Abbey programme and the swift and uncompromising response from women working in theatre, the arts and in the broader public sphere meant that a certain tone was struck, and suggested that perhaps the Waking the Feminist initiative, which has now travelled formally to New York theatres as well, would become one of the key outcomes of the centenary programme. While it is disappointing that the Waking the Feminist movement has not made stronger and broader links with other socially active feminist groups, such as the Repeal the Eighth Coalition, which has been petitioning very vocally in this election year and in fact is petitioning vocally today on our behalf in front of the reconvened Dáil, it is clear that women and women's social issues in an Irish context are coming to the fore during this commemorative period. All commemorations are ultimately about the present. They function as ways in which we explain to ourselves things about our culture that need articulation. They also allow us to describe for ourselves how we would like to be seen. The 50th anniversary of the Easter Rising provided an opportunity for Ireland to demonstrate its modernity. The Commemorative Act told that story again and again in 1966. The story that 2016 tells is only being shaped, of course, but it is clear that the narrative is being feminized in the context of the Irish Republic's marking of the Easter Rising. However, the all-Ireland perspective seems to have slipped slightly from view thus far. It is unclear whether this will change as the year progresses. After all, we still have before us the key commemorations of the Battle of the Somme, but it would seem that the 100th Rising commemoration is thus far less all-Ireland than the 90th, which of course occurred when consciousness of the peace process, its intentions and significance was perhaps higher. The narrative that is shaped by commemorative programs is unfolding, but despite the best of planning, despite invitations to all the right or wrong people, despite our best efforts to shape the narrative to our will, it will not be controlled. Just as writers interrupted the presentation of Synge and O'Casey's plays a century ago, so the fury of women artists interrupted the narrative that the Abbey sought to stage this year and forced its rewriting. Our gatherings here at Maynooth over the coming year offer the opportunity for reflection on the process of that narrative's gathering threads, as well as the opportunity to disrupt, to critique, and to reform. It's my great pleasure to introduce Martina Devlin, and I'm sorry, Martina, you ended up standing there through that very long introduction. No, I'm sorry, I would
have
asked you to
sit. Did you feel my breath on the back of your neck?
No, not at all, not at all.
Sorry.
Martina Devlin is probably known to all of you in her wearing her different hats. She's an author and journalist who's gathered accolades in both fields. The recipient of a Hennessy Irish Fiction Award and the winner of the V.S. Pritchett Prize, Martina's books have also been nominated several times for the Irish Book Awards, and she has been named the National Newspapers of Ireland Columnist of the Year. Her books range from the historical novel Ship of Dreams, based on a relative who perished on the Titanic, to her most recent novel about Sisterland, a dystopian story about a world by women that serves as a warning about extremism. Her 2014, The House Where It Happened, took inspiration from the last witchcraft trial in Ireland, which is one of my personal favorites, I have to say. And among her other books are a very moving memoir and the co-written Banksters, which tackled Ireland's banking crisis and should win an award just for its title alone. A former Fleet Street journalist, Martina has been writing a column for the Irish Independent for 9 years, tackling everything from the current Lewis crisis this week to the Abbey Theatre's Waking the Nation programme. Vice chair of the Irish Writers' Centre, Martina is at the forefront of Irish literary circles as well as journalistic ones, and we are honoured that she has taken the time to visit us here today. So please join me in welcoming Martina Devlin.
Thank you, everybody. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. So this is just a very informal presentation, and there'll be lots of opportunities to discuss some of the issues that come up afterwards. But I don't have many heroes, but this man is one of them, Roger Casement. And in fact, I chose that image of him because it shows him reading. He was a reader. He was a writer. He said himself, "I write, I write, I write." And I suppose, like all writers, he wrote to make sense of the world, but also to set the darkness echoing. His writing, though, changed things utterly. He was one of the first active humanitarians, not the only one, but one of the first. But he also employed journalistic techniques, and probably this is why I'm interested in him as well. He, to write government white papers for the colonial service, as a British consul, he understood first-person testimony. So instead of using go-betweens, he went out into the bush, if you like, and he interviewed both victims and perpetrators of violence, and all those accounts were woven through his documentation. He also took photographs, photojournalism as well. And I think we perhaps don't realise nowadays, but in his time, he was probably the most famous living Irishman. He had an extraordinary impact. In fact, probably better known outside of Ireland than inside of Ireland at the time of the Rising. Now, why would I be interested in him as a writer? Well, not only because he wrote, but because he was surrounded by writers and engaged with writers. And writers took inspiration from him and also wrote about him. People like Joseph Conrad, whom he knew in Africa. He was the inspiration for a character in Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. People like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who modelled a character in the Professor Challenger stories on Casement. It was a character called Sir John Roxton, or Roxbury, I'll have to think about that. But anyway, Sir John, who was a very gentlemanly explorer. So he had an influence on people. And then as well, after his death, W.B. Yeats wrote a number of poems, including The Ghost of Roger Casement is Beating at the Door, which was a cry for his remains to be repatriated. And Alice Milligan, a wonderful woman, a poet, an Irish language enthusiast, a magazine editor, very loyal to Casement, and went to his trial, and he waved at her across the room and sent a note across with his consul saying, "Are you going to write a poem about this, Alice?" Because she often wrote poetry about current affairs. And in fact, she did. She wrote two, in which she positioned the courtroom scene as a sort of Roman gladiatorial spectacle. And she always remembered him on the anniversary of his death, August the 3rd. She always gathered flowers and put them on the mantelpiece. So the writers who knew Roger Casement and with whom he interacted were loyal to him. In fact, writers got up a petition for clemency, that the death sentence would be commuted, headed by Arthur Conan Doyle, signed by people like Yeats, George Bernard Shaw, Galsworthy, lots of wonderful English writers, also the Irish historian Alice Stopford Green, but actually Conrad, who owed a lot of the Heart of Darkness to Casement, wouldn't sign and could never forgive him for turning against empire. So he was quite a divisive figure even in his day. But look, let me bring you back to the beginning. This is where it all started. And in some ways, perhaps it's where my burgeoning interest in Casement really, you know, came to the fore, because this is a house in Sandy Cove, a few minutes in South County Dublin, a few minutes walk from where I live. And I often walk past this house. And you'll see it's set back from the road. And it took me a few years before I realised it was the house where Casement was born, because next door to it is Buckley's Auction House. And I was always peering in there at treasures that you could get for half nothing in auction. It's sort of terribly impractical chandeliers and the like. And it took me a while to realise that this relatively modest house is where he was born, the son of a British Army captain from a fairly well-heeled unionist background, and a mother called Jeffson, who was Catholic and from Cork. The Cork Jeffsons, the family always said, who were quite a genteel family, but the Jeffsons themselves aren't convinced that there is a link, but the Casements say they're linked. So it's this blending of North and South. So already I'm intrigued by that. Then there's, you skip on. This is a plaque that you'd have to look quite hard for on the house. And it was put up in 1941, and it simply says that Roger Casement was born on the 1st of September, 1864, and he died on the 3rd of August, 1916, and rest in peace. It's fairly simple. This is a photograph I took on Easter Sunday the other week. I was lucky enough to actually be on O'Connell Street, though it was closed off to the public. And this is Michael D. laying a wreath. And it just struck me that Casement is both part of the pantheon of Irish heroes, if you like, but also apart from them for a number of reasons, not least because he was executed in London, but for all sorts of other complicated reasons as well. He doesn't fit easily into any narrative, and I think that that's why none of the political parties have rushed to claim him in the same way that Fianna Fáil claimed Dev and Fine Gael claimed Collins. He's a bit of a shapeshifter, really. And I don't say this in any pejorative sense. As a writer, that's what makes him so interesting. He's so hard to pin down. This is the family homestead. This is the Casement seat in Ballycastle in County Antrim. It's actually even larger than that. Casement scholar Geoffrey Dudgeon took this photo. Mahron Temple House. Called for a little church to St. Patrick in front of it. It is the most beautiful part of the Antrim coastline. And it was Casement's spiritual home and the closest he had to a home, because they were orphaned. His mother died when he was about 9, his father when he was 12 or 13. And the Casements then raised him between here and another part of Antrim. They shared the raising of the children. But this is where he was most at home. And this is where he really first grew to love his Irish heritage. There's a big library in there full of books. The most recent would be 100 years old, all about Irish history and folklore. And he would sit in the library reading. He wrote poetry as a teenager. It was published in magazines and newspapers of the time, gathered together after his death by one of his very loyal female cousins who were true to the end to him, and a collection brought out. But it all started here, really. And Casements still live here. Patrick Casement, whose grandfather was Casement's second cousin, lives here, and he's a zoologist. I've spoken to him, and he has lots of interesting family stories about Casement, and these really aren't on the record. You know, we know Casement, the loyal, the conscientious servant of empire, who then decided that the colonial system, having watched it up close and personal, smashed local people, was the word he used. Indigenous people did not benefit under the colonial system. That was one of the great myths of colonisation, that it brought civilization to the savage. In fact, Casement saw that it abused the savage, took their riches from them, took their work from them. So a lot of it happens here, and it really led to him eventually, I think it it inculcated this champion of the underdog ethos that he adopted. Not immediately. He worked in Liverpool initially for a shipping line. Went to Africa. Was found to be a very useful man. Was absorbed into the British consular service. Investigated human rights abuses in the Congo, dreadful, dreadful abuses, wrote a government white paper about it, excoriating King Leopold of the Belgians in what was then known as the Belgian Free Congo. King Leopold denied it all, and there was an independent commission of inquiry, this was it, and it absolutely found that everything Roger Casement had recorded and charted so diligently, all that writing, paid off. He logged everything, and it found in favour of his report, and it really sent shockwaves around the world. So he had a very distinguished service in the consular service. Ever before he turned his attention to Ireland, and it started just after this Congo Commission. He wrote the Congo report. He finalised it in Mahorin Temple House over Christmas 1903, and Patrick Casement, his descendant, a sort of remote cousin, told me that he was miserable. His diary records say he had a cold and it was miserable there, and he wasn't having a nice time at all, but he slogged away at the report. And then he subsequently took about 18 months off, and he spent time in his beloved Antrim and also in England, and really it's there that he re-engaged with his Irish identity. Patrick Casement tells me that he would walk the length and breadth of the area, and this very gentlemanly, they called him a soldiery-looking man because of his erect bearing, and he'd have holes in his boots because he was so absorbed that he wouldn't think to go and get his shoes repaired. And he'd speak to everybody. Locals there have told me that he'd come and he'd walk about their farms and he'd ask them questions. And about the Irish culture, he went to Rathlin Island, which you can see, it's very clear on the coast from there. I see some of you nodding, you're familiar with this part of the world. And on Rathlin Island, Patrick Casement told me, he walked around visiting all these deserted houses because of emigration. He could see what colonisation had meant, the stripping of wealth. And he turned back, arrived back at the pier holding a spinning wheel that he'd lifted in a deserted house, saying, it was at the west part of the island, and do you know who I can pay? Very honest man. Who can I pay? Who can I give the money to for this? And everybody said, sure, it's deserted, take it. But that desire to have the spinning wheel, it fed into his interest in Irish culture. And you see, from that, from an interest in the folklore and the language, grew a growing sense of identity as an Irishman. As with others at the time in the early 1900s, he dared to believe that Ireland could have an identity separate from empire, which was excessive and weary. And they invented a new construct of Ireland, people like Casement and Alice Milligan and Thomas MacDonagh, the crossover between culture and armed rebellion, you know, is one of the interesting elements of 1916. It grew out of a cultural movement. And Casement, as an Ulster Unionist, really, had this epiphany where he realised he was an Irishman. And, of course, this dates back to the United Irishman, the idea that you owe your allegiance not to the race from which you originate, but the country you live in, irrespective of class or creed. Absolutely extraordinary. So this consciousness raising, I suppose we'd call it now, happened there. But of course he went back into the colonial service, did more sterling work in the Amazon, another report, another shockwaves again. In fact, the report didn't change conditions in the Amazon so much as the fact that the market for wild rubber collapsed because you could get farmed rubber at this stage. But still, he was now knighted. He was now a pillar of the establishment. We're into 1911, 1912. And at this stage, he steps back again from the consular service. I mean, his health was ruined by malaria and by the atrocities he'd seen as well. Comes back to Ireland and becomes involved. He's here now in this beautiful part of Ireland. This is Murlough Bay. The townland is Kerry, and really, this is where he just became absorbed in Gaelic culture and wanted an Ireland free from British rule. And it was never an anti-Englishness, and I think it's important for us to remember this. It was an anti-system, establishment, ruling class, really. And it all happened here. This is where it germinated for him, and this is where it flowered. So I must move quickly on. This is a familiar image of Casement after his appeal has been overturned. So he went to Germany in what his relatives call was a naive exercise to raise an Irish brigade to fight in the rising against Britain. So Irish prisoners of war, Irishmen in the British Army who were prisoners of war in Germany, he thought that they could form an Irish brigade and come and fight for Ireland. He was only able to recruit 50-odd. It was a failure. When he went into the prisoner of war camp, he was mocked and insulted. And the Germans basically wanted rid of him and sent him, as he says, three men in a boat. He was sent in a submarine with arms, landed on Bannerstrand. The arms weren't landed. The captain had to scuttle the ship rather than have them get into British hands. And Casement was brought to London. He landed on Good Friday, was captured on the following day, brought after the rising to London, housed in the Tower of London, and after the rising there was a show trial. And, I mean, that's worth the whole talk in itself. But, you know, it was a done deal. He was never going to be exonerated. He was accused of espionage, sabotage, and he was accused of being a traitor, treason. So, which he denied. He denied. And his family, interestingly, think of him as a traitor. They do use that word about him even now, but they accept that they would think that he was misguided rather than evil. And they accept, they're happy that he's now being seen in the round as a humanitarian for all the work he did before becoming involved in the Irish question. Bear in mind, he was almost 49 before he became involved with the Gaelic League and with Fechina in Antrim and things like that. So this is Pentonville, where he was executed. It was an old Victorian prison. This is how they used to exercise the prisoners in Pentonville. They'd have to wear cloth masks over their face when they were exercised so they couldn't communicate. So quite a Dickensian prison. And he was executed there, famously, in 1916, and he converted to Catholicism shortly before his execution, which again has helped to bring him into this idea of a Catholic martyr, but he was much more than that. Anyone recognise a familiar face here? This is De Valera beside the Celtic cross in the foreground. So any time I've written about Casement, I've only written about him journalistically. I'm in the middle of trying to write a short story about him. I don't know if it will come to anything because he is a very difficult man to pin down. There are so many elements to him. But finally, in 1965, his remains were repatriated to Ireland. The Irish successive Irish governments had asked and asked for his remains. He'd been treated really disrespectfully. He was thrown into the prison yard in Pentonville after he was hanged naked and buried in quicklime, and two hanged murderers thrown in on top of him. And what was really unforgivable is that his naked body, before he was buried, was subjected to an anal examination because the British authorities wanted proof that he had been a homosexual, which, I'm using terminology from the time, obviously, which was a criminal offence at the time. And it was all part of words being used against Casement. Other people's words, his own words, whether they were truly his words or whether they sexed up the dossier. The jury's out on that. But words were used against Casement, and they wanted further evidence. Although you might say, if they were convinced the Black Diaries were genuine, why did they feel they needed an anal examination to prove that he was, you know, to use the kind of terminology they would, that he was aberrant? So anyway, Ireland continued to press for his remains to be repatriated. It happened finally in 1965. And any time I write about him, I have a huge post bag. And I had a letter recently after I wrote about him again. And I write about him because I want to keep him in the public consciousness. And I think that people have forgotten so many elements to him. And I think that it does him a disservice to only see him in his 1916 context. And I had a most interesting letter from someone saying that as a boy, he went to this. He's a retired doctor living in Fox Rock in Dublin now. And he said that as school children, they were all given a day off school. I love this social history, this recollection of what happened, which you can cross-reference and check because memory can be faulty too. But he got a day off school, went to see the lying in state, which happened for 5 days, and then to the funeral. Also, public servants were allowed time off work to go to the funeral procession. And he said to me that De Valera, who was in his mid-80s by the time, and it was the tail end of winter 1965, it was February, March 65, the time it all, you know, he was repatriated in February and then March when he was buried. De Valera, against doctor's orders, gave the oration. And he said, this doctor said to me that he's never forgotten this old man standing in the sleet and the bitter weather with his ungloved hand resting on the coffin as he gave the oration and spoke about how he was back among his own people. So I found that testimony interesting. He also claimed, and I'd love if there are any historians among you to cross-reference it, that cement was poured in after the coffin in Glasnevin so that casement could not be dug up again and brought to Antrim, because it was casement's his dying wish expressed in a letter to his cousins, the Bannisters, who were always loyal to him. Although I should say that the men, you know, the casement men contributed privately to his defence fund. And bear in mind, they were fighting at the front. So, you know, totally opposite ends of the spectrum. They were horrified by his actions. He wanted to be buried in Murlock Bay, wrote of it most poignantly, and it's the writer in him here at this point, these letters from Pentonville when he knows that the hangman's noose is waiting for him. Most poignant letters, and I think no writer, no reader can fail to respond to a particular one to the Bannisters, where he says, more or less he says, look, I'm not actually here. I'm not in this condemned cell in Pentonville. In my mind's eye, I'm in Murlock Bay, and he says very specifically that he sees himself by the Macaries, who are a family there. I've spoken to them; they still farm land there. They're by the Macaries. He's by the Macaries land there on Murlock Bay, and there's the little old ruined church, and that's where I am now. He's saying so. This leap of imagination, you know, prison walls aren't holding him, and that's where I'd like to lie. And he says, don't let my bones lie here. But you see, even after death, he was too controversial a figure. And Harold Wilson's government released him to the Irish government on condition that he would not be sent north, on the basis that it would fire up the Catholics and equally it would fire up the Protestants. So even after death, this idea of him being a rallying point for or against a cause, interesting. Finally... you'll have to get a grappling hook and take me off when I start about casement. This image, this is Murlock Bay again. This is a little cross that was put up and a plaque to him last year by one of the Macaries, Fintan Macari, a young man who feels that casement isn't properly remembered, that his generation has forgotten casement. And there had been a great big stone cross which was blown up in 1957 and attacked by unionists and finally had to be taken down as it was a danger. But this has gone up, this simple little cross, and just a plaque there saying who he was. And, you know, I suppose to give the last word to his family, they say they don't want him dug up again and enough is enough. But it's rather, I think... where your bones lie aren't so relevant. It's Can you continue to inspire people? Do you still have something to say to future generations? And what's fascinating about Casement is he inspires writers, he inspires academics, he inspires political debate. I think that it's to do with the many sides to this man. He was known as Roddy, Rory, Roger, Sir Roger. By the way, he had his knighthood stripped of him before he was executed. But I noticed that in the official documentation from the Wilson government, as regards the repatriation, they called him Sir Roger. So names don't matter so much. He had many names. He adopted many persona. And I think I'll just leave you with that. Perhaps we can talk about some of those incarnations later. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Martina. I actually got tears in my eyes when the image of De Valera with his hand over the coffin. Now I'm going to cry and disgrace myself. Our next speaker is Dr. Margaret Ward, who's currently an honorary fellow in the School of History and Anthropology at Queen's University Belfast, where she had previously been a fellow at the Institute of Irish Studies. Having lectured at Bath Spa University, Margaret also served as Assistant Director of Democratic Dialogue, the Northern Ireland think tank founded to facilitate exchange between Protestants and Catholics in the post-peace process era, and was Director of the Women's Resource and Development Agency until 2013. While actively working as a policymaker, Margaret has also published an incredible body of academic work that positions her as an important feminist historian. The author of biographies of Maud Gunn and Hannah Shee Skeffington, Margaret is also the author of the landmark study Unmanageable Revolutionaries, Women and Irish Nationalism, which I'm sure most of you have come across, first published in 1993 and reissued with a new introduction in 1995. She has edited several other collections and has written extensively on the suffrage movement and on women's history more broadly. At present, she is working on a publication of Hannah Shee Skeffington's writings, forthcoming in 2018, and we're delighted that Margaret has agreed to join us here today. So please join me in welcoming Margaret Ward.
Thank you, Una. Thank you all for coming. This is a bit stream of consciousness. No, yours was very polished, Martina. Really enjoyed it, and I enjoyed the fact that you're linking North and South in what you say, because that's, you know, what I want to do as well. Just want to start, not so much in terms of history, but one of the organisations I've been involved with in the North for a number of years as part of the women's organisation I was with is one called Reclaim the Agenda, and it brings together women's organisations, feminist individuals, under a kind of a collective umbrella to live a life free from poverty, discrimination, to have a health care, to live our lives free from domestic violence and abuse, to live in a society where women are equally represented as decision makers, and to have access to good, affordable and flexible childcare provision, things that are also part of what women in the 26 counties would be looking for. But we have something different. Each year we've been able to have a big International Women's Day event with lectures, a big march through the city centre, and a civic reception by the City Hall and the Lord Mayor comes out, which we've worked very hard to get and worked very hard to be cross-community. Now, this year, it was Women Reclaim the 1916 Agenda, and the first time the programme was printed, it included, and this, the printer had just put this in, a still from, I think it's from Rebellion. I mean, it's not an historical one, but it had women in military uniform, and that just couldn't work. We had to that had to be taken out of circulation, and another copy done with the International Women's Day March Reclaim the Agenda. Such are the sensitivities in the North that even when you're working together as feminists, there's still a difficulty. So that, for example, at the moment, in terms of the decade of centenaries, we've been able to bring in some things that women have done that maybe wouldn't be seen as important, but because they're seen as a bit of a corrective to or an addition to what we know about nationalism, I've been able to have events in the City Hall. For example, we had a big thing on suffrage, but we included in that the fact that in June 1912, women from all over Ireland came together in a big mass meeting in Dublin to demand the inclusion of women in Home Rule. And this included unionist women because they had said the principle of citizenship was what was important. And at that moment, we won't look at the context, but we just want people to say women should be included. And we also then last year for the 2015 commemoration were able to have another meeting or a big event in City Hall that Myrtle Hill and myself spoke to, which was about the Women's Peace Congress in The Hague, when women from Ireland should have gone over there. In fact, it was for the first time Ireland was going to have a separate representation, not part of Britain, but an Irish delegation to be part of the Congress, which was to treat with all the belligerent countries and ask them to come to mediation rather than continue this dreadful warfare. The British government refused passports and then closed the North Sea, so the Irish and the British delegation couldn't go. But there was a big protest meeting in Dublin that Patrick Pearce sent a message to. Thomas McDonough spoke at the platform for, and you could see Republicans and feminists coming together. And also separately in Belfast, we had Margaret McCubry, a suffragette, organising a peace campaign. So we've been able to try and extend the boundaries and talk about women and use the fact that they want balance, you know, to do more than look at what is the main narrative. But, you know, I'm still surprised at how much there has been, how much focus there has been on women in 1916 now. And I was thinking back to last year when I started getting invitations to speak and wondering how big it was. But it is, for me, as somebody who's been writing for a long time, 30 years and coming, it's not a, we're not an overnight success. There's been a lot of work being done. So, I'm always wondering, do people not have an historical sense when they suddenly think we're an overnight success, that we're not? And what we need to do then is how to maintain the momentum, because I do feel the backlash is coming. And I just want to talk a little bit about that. But I was thinking about what the catalyst was for this. And Una's referred to the Waking the Feminist, which obviously is a key moment. And when we're looking back, we will go and see that as a key moment. But it is, for me, looking from the north, a pity that there hasn't been a greater linking of that with all of the other things. We still seem to be very separate. But I noticed last summer I was on holiday and I had a tweet that there was going to be a big meeting in the London Irish Centre in London. And it was Ireland's three most prominent historians were going to be talking on 1916 and women, and the three were all men. And I tweeted something quite rude about that, and people started. And so when I was on holiday, I just felt great because you were kind of a community of people who were feeling the same thing. And the historian Mary McAuliffe coined the term Manil Watch. So we started looking at that, and more people seemed to join in. And it did come to the stage where it was not feasible for them to have that meeting without putting a woman on the panel. And so we did get that change, but then they continued putting out the same poster. So we were then tweeting, well, who are the three most prominent, since there are now four on the panel? And they were going, sorry, that was a, you know, meant to change that, you know. So then I think after that, people have been much more careful, because History Hedge School was still having three male and not wondering that there was an issue, and they wouldn't do that now. So I think that kind of pressure does lead to results, but that kind of pressure needs to be kept up, because, you know, people can slip back into the old ways very, very quickly. And I do think that we do have a new generation of feminists, North and South. We've got the Repeal the Eighth. We have an Alliance for Choice and all sorts of pro-choice groups in the North. Here you've had the Women for Election campaign, and so much discussion on representation of women, which has definitely fed into the whole decade of commemorations, and the new research in energy of a new generation of historians, which is great to see, and a new range of books coming out, and all of the extra Bureau of Military History, the pensions applications, so much more information that we can now have a much more nuanced understanding of what women did do at the time. But I'm thinking now, people are starting even now to reflect on what has happened in the last few months. So I was thinking of Una Mullally in the Irish Times recently, and she looked at this and said that definitely the work of the historians now has contributed to this, because anyone who's had a book out recently, and particularly thinking of the book of the 77 women of Kilmainham and how that fed into the big state commemoration of women imprisoned after the rising. But also Una says that some politicians were key to this, and she mentions Heather Humphreys and Edna O'Riordan. So you do need those kind of champions to also make sure that women are represented. But I was interviewed by BBC on Easter Sunday, BBC Northern Ireland, and one of the questions which really threw me, I wasn't interviewer said, well, we've been told now that there's been too much emphasis on women, and what do you think about that? And I thought, has it started already? This is Easter Sunday. We haven't even got over. And in fact, in real terms, the rising still hasn't taken place. And we're told that, you know, there's too much emphasis on women. And I felt, well, they would say that, wouldn't they? You know, that we have to be prepared for that. And Mary McAuliffe, we were just in communication, and she's saying that some historians are now saying that 2016 has been all about the women. And, you know, she feels that we have struck a nerve. And there has to be some kind of discussion, because we still have North and South key male historians who are very happy to talk about all the work on women and never would say, maybe you should have, you know, one of the women who's written some of this on as well. And, you know, if it's 10% of women who took part in the Easter Rising, we still haven't even got 10% of the books. If you go to Hodgkiss and Figgis or something, what will you see there? You'll still see this very male-dominated publishing. But when I was speaking in the RTE Easter Monday celebrations reflecting the rising, and I don't know if any of you were there in Dublin, fantastic occasion when so many historians were there, and we were rushing from giving talk to the next talk, something that I would never have thought we would have experienced. And you could see RTE really wanting to make sure that women were properly represented, so that there were talks on women of all sorts of different aspects of women's contribution to those revolutionary years. You know, it was a frustration that, you know, we couldn't go to, especially if you were giving them, that you couldn't actually go and hear other people. But now we've come, I think, to the kind of backlash. Victoria White, I don't know if any of you seen that, some of you are nodding from the Irish Examiner. And it's always more distressing, I think, if it's a woman who speaks. And, you know, they can be the outliers for, you know, what a lot of other people want to say. But she talked about this determined warping of the historical fact, focusing obsessively on a tiny group of women, some of whom were just bonkers. I mean, it's a really offensive article, apart from anything else. And she says that, look, it was all gendered male, women had bit parts. And that people who were writing about women were not standing against the mass massacre of men in war, but were just lionising the few women prepared to take part in the massacre. Very, very offensive. And I would disagree strongly with that's what the kind of history that's coming out, if it's been about that. It totally ignores the way we've been trying to gender the discussion on 1916, on how women's roles and what they did at the time reveals about the position of women in the society and reveals the ideals of the revolution, why the proclamation came about, what was the future that people hoped to achieve. Now, I'm hoping that we do have an unstoppable surge of energy and interest. We certainly have full houses at events when women are part of the subject. But I think we need to ensure that these events that include women continue and don't stop throughout the next part of the decade, and how we can strategize and capitalize on that, and what are the issues we want to see included? Can we bring more things into the decade, women-defined issues, and what would they be? And for me, thinking 2017, what's important about that? As an historian, one of the things would certainly be looking at what happened to Sinn Féin. What happened to bringing together the political movement after the Rising? And we can see through the formation of the League of Women Delegates almost immediately after the Rising that women from all the different organisations were coming together, strategising on how they could be represented. They did things like they went on a delegation to the Sinn Féin office and said, we want to have reserved seats in Sinn Féin. You're reserving them now for the prisoners coming out of the camps. You're reserving them for... We want it for women. And these were women, Helena Maloney, Jenny Wise-Power, women who had been active for decades in the movement, and they didn't get it. I mean, they were sent away, and the women were very angry. If you see the minute book of this time, and they're strategising for the big Sinn Féin convention of 1917. This is going to be key to how the movement moves forward. And they're writing, well, you know, they're hoping to have a caucus meeting before the convention where women will come from all over the country and they hope that they can get them together. Actually, there's only a handful of women throughout Ireland who are selected as delegates in 1917, so they can't do that. But they do press forward and they do get women onto the Sinn Féin executive, women like Kathleen Clark, etc. So the history books always say, wasn't Sinn Féin great? And they have women on the executive, and that's all you really get. And you need to be uncovering what happened, and it feeds into the whole issue of women and representation nowadays and the issue of quotas. That isn't new. That was being talked about in 1917. So that's one of the issues I would like to see linking up, and it links up north and south, north with our abysmal representation. But then it brings us up into 1918 as well, and women getting the vote. I was just talking to some people who are very political, very clued up, and I was saying, of course, you know, I'm really interested in 28. And they're going, why? And I'm thinking, oh, my God, we've still got a long way to go, that we can't assume that people know that women over 30 got the vote in 1918. And not only that, but that Constance Markievicz was the first woman to be elected and obviously was elected to Westminster, though she didn't take a seat. And for the North, that Winifred Kearney was also a candidate. Now, my worry is that we'll have something ceremonial. You know, Westminster and the Doyle will do something together and they'll congratulate each other on that. And it will be left at that kind of ceremonial level. It won't engage and it won't... you know, it's not like they'll go around the countryside again with a copy of the proclamation for everybody or talk about the rights and opportunities and the suffrage of all people, etc. There's an awful lot to unpick about all of that, that I think that I really want to make sure that we have that on the agenda. And then, you know, later on, the War of Independence and the Civil War is going to bring its own challenges because you had so much of women being blamed, women the furies, the men wouldn't have gone to war if it hadn't been for women, etc., etc. So finally, just this is my kind of, was kind of stream of consciousness thinking about we really need North and South to get together about that. We need to start strategizing about that, thinking about the politicians who could be the champions. And once the Senate elections have taken place, you know, hopefully women like Ivana Bacic will be back there and that we can talk to them. Who were on the government advisory board for the decade? You know, who can we meet with? Linking up with Women for Elections, the National Women's Council, the representative groups for women, academia, what works are going to be published in that time. And that's why I want my collected writings of Hannah Shee Skeffington to time with that. You know, is there something else that we can we put out a call? Can we find out so that there is some kind of collective presence for that? And then finally, when I was in Connolly Station yesterday, making my way down here, I happened to meet Katrina Crowe, and I was talking to her, and she said she was sorry that she wasn't able to come today and how important these kinds of initiatives are. So I said about 2018, and she said immediately, we need to do something about it because it'll be ignored or it'll be done in a very minimal way. She said, we need a committee. We need to look for funding to make sure things are done, and that she would be happy to be involved in that. So I think that that's the kind of initiative I'd like to see coming out, and seeing how we can do it, and also just maintaining that social media presence and all of the other things. Because although I have worked as an academic, I've also spent half my life as a campaigner, and it's linking those two things together that I'm particularly interested in, and to see if we can do a bit more north and south as well. Okay.
Thank you so much, Margaret, for a fascinating series of suggestions, really, about how we can approach the coming centenaries. Our final speaker today, and my apologies, I actually should have said that far earlier, Jardine Meaney had to pull out due to illness. So we really regret that she couldn't be here today. So our last speaker today is Sophie Ward. Do you need PowerPoint or anything?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
I'm good.
Sophie is a PhD candidate at Queen's University Belfast School of Politics, International Studies and Philosophy. Her doctorate investigates Ulster loyalism as misrecognised in political science terms and seeks to reconsider loyalism's contributions to the peace process as a way of reformulating a progressive unionist theory. Sophie is a project administrator of the QUB-based AHRC, and is it still called AHRC? Was that the new incarnation? I always mix up which it used to be. Anyway, I think it's AHRC-funded and Heritage Lottery-funded project Living Legacies 1914 to 1918, which considers the way in which the First World War continues to impact communities in the present and works towards the idea of shared futures. At a moment when it's particularly important to have a diverse range of voices discussing commemoration as we move towards other commemorations that will be more contested, we're delighted that Sophie has agreed to speak today and welcome her back to Maynooth.
Thanks very much. Okay, so first of all, that was excellent. I'd attended an event on the suffragettes in the Black Box in Belfast, which had looked into some of the history 100 years on, and it was attended mostly by women, but there were friends of mine from the Progressive Unionist Party who wanted to go because they said, I didn't know how many unionist women were involved in the suffragette movement, and that's fascinating because we're always told that Republican women were more progressive. So these things, whenever they are put on, do attract new audiences. There are young women, young loyalist women who are interested in it. Also, I'm not a historian, so what I'm going to talk about is, there's two separate bits I can talk about. The first bit is how loyalists have been responding to this decade of commemorations, and loyalist women as well. And the second bit is how we at Living Legacies have experienced working with communities in trying to offer a gendered outlook or exploration of these centenaries. So for the first part, the loyalist responses to the Rising have largely been framed in terms of reaction to dissident republicanism, and that's because of loyalism's position as a working class identity, which in urban areas in particular often comes into contact with militant republicanism. So in areas like Belfast or Lurgan or Derry, Londonderry, at the moment, the groups that I've been talking to are understanding the Rising, and this is how they've framed it, and I'll speak about an event organised by a SOM association which kind of fed this. They see it as an undemocratic, violent initiative by a small group of people to kind of overthrow the rights and wishes of the many. So they then read that in parallel with the efforts of dissident Republicans today. part of the reason that they're saying these things is because of some of the narratives emerging from Sinn Féin in the north of Ireland, which is that the dissidents don't have any democratic mandate and they shouldn't be using violence. It's an illegitimate way to pursue political goals. In a meeting with Tony Novosel, who's an American academic who's written quite a good book on loyalism in the 70s and 80s, we met, some of the Progressive Unionist Party and him met about 2 weeks ago, and he said it's going to be very, very difficult for loyalism in the next few weeks coming up to Easter. He said, and one of our councillors asked if they should attend events commemorating the Rising because people are quite sensitive about it. And Arlene Foster's reasons for not participating in the commemorations were that it was a celebration and she wouldn't be doing that. So what Tony said was, yes, loyalism has a role to play, and what we should be doing is asking Republicans to come along and explain why they are celebrating the Rising. What is there to celebrate about that? What they understand it to be, and what does that mean now? So not to shy away from it, but to start to destabilise some of the narratives. And then he went on to say that what Sinn Féin are arguing at the moment in relation to the dissidents is not coherent with their celebration of the men of 1916. And it's always the men, but it doesn't. They don't sit together. So if a small group of people have the right to use violence in order to establish freedoms or a particular vision of a better way of life for people, what is there to criticise about the dissidents, right? So you can't celebrate one and undermine the other. And at a further event, and this was organised by the Ankara Psalm Association, and it was held in Brownlow House in Lurgan. It was 2 Fridays ago. It was a really interesting event. I was asked to go along because it was a day prior to a victory on the home front Easter Rising parade held by Unionists. So in response to the idea that dissidents would be marching in Lurgan, celebrating the Easter Rising, Unionists decided to march to commemorate the British Army personnel who were killed that day. So their response to this kind of masculinised military celebration was to counter with their own. So at no point during the evening did a woman speak. I was invited to watch and enjoy. But at no point during the evening did a woman speak. In order to kind of undermine the morality of the rebels, they would mention that women and children had been killed. So they were obviously the passive recipients of violence. They didn't mention any of the female participants in the Rising at all as being agents of violence or political thought. But the way that they destabilised it, and there was around 100 people in the room. Arlene Foster was invited. She didn't attend. But there were some prominent DUP and UUP members there. They had a lieutenant colonel from the British Army, and he gave a PowerPoint presentation, and he used a military strategy to deconstruct the actions of the rebels. And he, I was very uncomfortable with it because it was incredibly disrespectful, but it served a purpose. It served to soothe the kind of fears of Unionists there that, don't worry, militarily we are better. And that was laid out as being a desirable thing, to be militarily better. And that even at the time, the Irish government and the Irish press were against the rebels. So it was in a way to comfort people. They didn't have much support then, and they don't have much support now. And militarily, they were very poor. So he was going through the different areas of Dublin, which the rebels had taken over, and he was pointing out things like, well, they didn't consider how to get food in or water in, and how were they going to bring in support? And, you know, he calls himself a captain. He pointed this pretty figure. He calls himself a captain, and I snigger. And everybody laughed. Because this kind of symbol of Unionist military power, he was lieutenant colonel, was telling them not to worry, that the rebels were poorly organised. They were always doomed to fail. He gave the ratios that the British Army prefer in attacking the enemy, which I think are between, is it 3 to 5, next to 1 of the enemy, in order to attack a position. And he said, we only had 2, so the odds were against us, but we were still able to defeat them. That's how poorly organised they were. So on that evening, there was no mention of women. There were women in attendance, there was no mention of women, and it was about matching the subpar military strategy of Republican men with the superior military power of Unionist men. who obviously had right on their side as well. That was the subtext of it. And then the next day in Lurgan, there was an unnotified parade of dissident Republicans. So they were wearing masks. I think some of them had weapons. And the police stayed well back. And part of that is the policing strategy is not to confront the dissidents because Lurgan's quite a sensitive area. So they're letting them parade with the idea that a parade is less harmful than possible confrontation. Particularly given that a prison officer was killed using a dissident bomb about 3 weeks ago in Belfast. So the next day, following this kind of triumphalist event in Brownlow House, unionists were able to see that the police force and the parades commission were not on their side. And then this caused some discomfort. But it was masked men parading. And on the following Monday, when unionists wanted to parade, it was men parading as well. Women look on. This is a big kind of thing in unionist culture. The flute bands will sometimes accept female members, but it tends to be mostly men. And women, if you ever read Rachel Ward's book, they're tea makers. They'll make the sandwiches in the Orange Hall afterwards. And it is quite a complex set of ideals coming into contact with one another, because you do have feminists who would identify as loyalists, who find it very, very difficult to participate in these cultural practices because their roles are so constrained. So the loyalist response to this has largely been to blame the police for not doing what they're expected to do. And none of it has been historical. It's all security oriented. And I would argue that that is because these people aren't operating in academia. They're not operating on a theoretical level. They're operating in terms of survival. In particular in Lurgan, in West Belfast, in North Belfast, where there are interfaces, some of the feminist, loyalist women that I'm talking about are active in trying to keep the peace walls up, because they have experience of things coming over the walls regularly, of people being pursued round the side of the security gates. So whenever they talk about the Easter Rising, what it means to them isn't that we're not remembering women. What it means to them is that it could cause someone to lose a life now. So the women aren't really being given opportunity to undertake any historical explorations, because in these working class areas with a high risk of violence, there's very little space to consider that, because they're worried about their sons and their daughters and their husbands, and they're worried about their homes. However, there has been good work done with loyalist women. Philip Orr and I took a group of women from the Falls and the Shankill to the Ulster Museum World War I exhibition about a month ago. And then we'd borrowed a handling box from the Saul Museum, which had a uniform in it and some shrapnel and water bottle and different bits and pieces. We were walking around the museum, and the women were kind of looking at the different things. So the Ulster Museum has tried quite hard in this exhibition to represent the Rising and the Somme and World War One fairly equally. So if you go in and see it, you'll see that you've got in this big kind of pillar, you've got the proclamation on one side, and then you have the 36th Ulster Division flag, which was in Thiepval, hanging on the other side, and a kind of visual representation of parity of esteem. And the majority of complaints have come from unionists. This is supposed to be our museum. This is supposed to be a public expression of our history. And why are they receiving equal status? So the women walking around the museum were kind of pointing different things out. And then Philip said, well, is there anything you don't see? And they said, oh, well, what were the women doing? And there's a small section which showed kind of what women would have been wearing. Some propaganda posters appealing to women about what roles they could play and how to obviously conserve food and support the war effort. But in the follow-on discussion, whenever they were talking about their knowledge of the war, they were saying things like, oh, my husband's read your book. My husband is fascinated by this. Him and his friends are going to go to the Somme this coming July. But I'd love to know more about the women. So part of their role in being unionist women was obviously to support their husband's endeavours. But through places like the Shankill Women's Centre, the Falls Women's Centre, they are starting to kind of question the narrow history that they're being presented with. Now, it takes a little bit of, stimulus and provocation, because unlike feminist scholars, they don't look at things straight away and say, where are the women? But there is good work being done there. In terms of loyalist women and the suffragettes, there's a feminist in Belfast called Kelly O'Dowd who works for Trademark, which is a trade union organisation. And she told me that during the height of the union flag protests, which would have been, so they started in December 2012, I think this was around January, February 13, she was running a course on suffragettes in East Belfast with Greenway Women's Centre. And the flag protests were particularly violent and prolonged in East Belfast. So the women were inside. She said there was maybe six or seven of them. And she was teaching them this, and she was kind of explaining what had happened to women for them to get the vote. And there was guys outside standing with a flag at the road. And one of the women looked at her and said, she waited at the end of the class, and she said, like, that's something worth dying for, isn't it? And then looked outside at the men, as if she'd suddenly realised these idiots have been leading us for so long and deciding when we go and confront the police and when we engage in riotous behaviour, when we risk our lives and our children's lives. And she'd suddenly been given this history where she thought that's worth dying for. However, how far those women can go with that within those patriarchal structures is unclear. There's some research done on the women's roles in the flag protest, and Michael Potter has written quite a good article on it where he said that the women had quite a dominant role in the flag protest where they were able to lead them. But the reason they were able to lead them was because everybody decided it was better for the women to lead them because the police were less likely to attack the women than the men. So the men hung back and the women went to the front. So they were given permission to participate on that occasion, and they enjoyed it. And they criticised the men for not being where they should be and not supporting them adequately. But it's clear that power wasn't taken permanently. It was just kind of temporarily handed over because it was pragmatic. Just a final point from a political perspective. Belfast City Council has been trying very, very hard. Their last chief executive was very keen on maintaining good relations, and actually maintaining good relations, not just nominally doing it. So when it came to funding 2016, Belfast City Council had £250,000 to pay for public events. And again, if you're aware of the history of the flag protest, you'll know that Belfast City Council is roughly equally unionist and nationalist, and the Alliance Party can kind of tip each way in terms of a vote. But what they decided to do was just split it down the middle. So they gave £125,000 for the Easter Rising, they gave £125,000 for the Somme, and they divided it that way to the respective camps. So one group, History Hub Ulster, has got the unionist money, because that's what it is, it's unionist money, and the Republican equivalent has got their £125,000. There was, as far as I know, because our party was in the discussions, there was no attempt to make any of this cross-community. I was at a workshop in Belfast about 3 months ago, and there was a group of clergy from, I think it was OMA, and they had invited myself, Jason Burke, who researches World War I in East Belfast, and Tom Hartley, the former Sinn Féin Lord Mayor, who would do very good research on republicanism in the war. And their hope was that, and there were some Somme associations there too, their hope was that they could have a shared remembrance service, maybe in August, for both the Rising and the Somme. So they listened to like each group's perspectives. Tom spoke, I spoke, Jason spoke. And then they said, well, what are the chances of that happening? And I said, well, that's not up to me. You need to speak to the groups who are active in remembering these things. You need to speak to Somme associations. And one of the Somme guys spoke up and he said, why would I remember them? They were traitors. He said, at the very least, I let them get on with what they want to get on with. And I have a couple of quotations here from there's a loyalist Facebook group that I helped run. And I'll give you these so you have an indication of the kind of feeling towards the Easter Rising within Loyalism. So there is some hope, as I said, that there can be shared remembering. But if you like dig a little deeper at all, you'll see that I'm not sure if it's marked along class lines or in terms of experience of violence. I haven't quite unpacked that yet. I think it's along class lines. But Sinn Féin's Patrice Hardy, in the newsletter, January, February 2015, had said, a civic event should be held to mark the centenary of the Easter Rising in Mid and East Antrim Council. So Mid and East Antrim Council would be mixed, reasonably unionist area. So in this loyalist group that I helped to run, someone said, they're entitled to remember their dead, but holding a civic reception to honour the rising is taking the piss. Innocent people died when their heroes tried to hold wartime Ireland to ransom. There is nothing honourable about that heinous rebellion. That's a man commenting. The second one is, a memorial service to remember the 116 British soldiers and 16 Royal Irish Constabulary men killed would be acceptable. And then the final comment is from one. Let them have their wee commemoration for the cowardly thugs. Meanwhile, I will be participating in and watching events where real brave men, Protestants and Catholics, died at the Battle of the Somme. So I've said a couple of things about this before, and my conclusion is that the Battle of the Somme is so integral to the Unionist identity, which is constructed in opposition to the Republican identity, that we can only ever have tolerance of the Easter Rising. Now, I think there is greater scope for a gendered exploration of that in terms of the women, because particularly in response to some of the suffragette stuff, loyalist and unionist women were fascinated by the idea that women used violence to get what they wanted from men who wouldn't give it to them. So whilst unionist and loyalist men tend to have a very strong emotional connection to the Somme and therefore a rejection of the legitimacy of the rising, I think there's greater scope for the women, simply because women who are reasonably political within loyalist circles are very interested in historically the things that women have done in order to wrest some power from the hands of men. So that's my hope, and there are great people who are able to do that. So I leave it there. Thank you very much.